Larry Kleinman, welcome again to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be here again.
Larry is well-known in Oregon as one of the OGs, original gangsters, with Cipriano Farrell and Ramon Ramirez. They founded PICOON, the Oregon Farm Workers Organization. Larry, for how many years was it, Larry, the secretary-treasurer of PICOON?
For 25 years.
25 years, who was... He was instrumental in building the organization and the movement, and he especially was important in the entire PICOON housing development in Woodburn, and also in the radio station, among many other achievements. And Larry is still doing radio himself, in fact, nationally. You can tell us about that, Larry.
Well, I have a show on Radio Movimiento, our station. It's called La Resistencia de Más Potencia, the most powerful resistance, and well, I'm occasionally a commentator on Línea Abierta of Radio Bilingüe, national call-in show.
A national call-in show.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a big personality, actually, in Hispanic media.
No, I'm a minor. Pinch hitter, actually. It'd be more accurate.
But you hit a home run every now and then. It's a good pinch hitter.
Concise but powerful, hopefully.
Good. Larry, you left full-time and more work, of course, with PICOON in 2013 to work partly on the national stage. Today we're going to be discussing the immigrant movement, particularly Trumpism, and now his defeat and the future of immigration politics. First, though, what have you been doing for the last 5 years, and what are you now doing besides doing the radio?
So I stepped down 5 years ago as part of generational shift of leadership. I was succeeded by Jaime Arredondo, a young farm worker from Salem, as part of a planned series of shifts, including Ramon Ramirez's retirement, which will happen next year. He's the president of PICOON. I took up roles nationally in helping groups like PICOON around the country in the immigrant rights movement build their capacity to serve and defend the community, and also have tried to serve as a thought partner to people, both in the immigrant rights movement and beyond, and as a mentor to younger leaders as they call upon me to support them. I think the key thing is what I'm not doing, which is I'm no longer managing organizations. I'm no longer a decision maker. I'm really an advisor and a supporter of younger leadership who's taking on the full role.
And you can actually look back at some of the achievements of the immigration movement, particularly in Oregon. We'll talk about Measure 105. That was extremely successful, and we'll talk about that. So, Larry, in the recent election, Trump made the election a referendum on him and his policies. He really did lose big, but he still runs the whole immigration apparatus, including the INS and ICE and Homeland Security and Border Patrol. It's an enormous investment that we're all paying for. Give us a brief rundown on Trumpism and its impact and the impact of the recent midterm.
So I think that Trump has been very effective at endless demonization and racial displacement anxiety, by which I mean speaking to white people in a way that raises their anxiety about white people being displaced in this country now and in the future. And he's used immigration. It was no accident that he suddenly made the so-called caravan and the 14th Amendment birthright citizenship big issues, seemingly out of nowhere, because they speak in a pretty obvious way to those two things, demonizing and to the racial displacement anxiety. I don't think it really worked for him. It worked for him in some places where his rural base remains strong, but in seemingly with suburban voters, especially with suburban women voters, those were the predominant districts that were lost to the Republican Party, won by Democrats in the midterm election.
And the midterms, there's some astounding things happen. Two Muslim women are joining the House of Representatives, and women candidates within the Democratic Party, the Sanders upsurge, led to the defeat of a number of well-placed and powerful and respected conservative Democrats. We should see that the Democrats are primarily a conservative party. There are some lefties and radicals in it, like Sanders, but they're a minority still in the Democratic Party. But those people now know that they have a problem with, in fact, this left upsurge in terms of their own personal electoral futures.
Right. I think that's right. And also I look at Texas, where Beto O'Rourke ran against Ted Cruz. He lost narrowly, but I think was widely believed to have outperformed what one would have expected. But even though he didn't manage to get victory, his effect of mobilizing younger voters, of turning out Latino voters, voters who infrequently participate, managed to turn at least two House seats in the Houston area, and a whole raft of local races, including judges, county executives.
In Houston.
Around the state, but in particular in the
Valley. In all the big cities.
And in the big cities, exactly.
El Paso and San Antonio and Dallas. Really, the Democrats are. I mean, these people are now in control.
Right, and this is the untold story, or the soon-to-be-told story, which is below the congressional level, at the state legislative level, at the local government level, there was a whole series of folks elected who are not the usual kinds of candidates and who represent a new demographic.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Larry Kleinman, who was one of the founders of Bakun, our farm workers movement, and then moved on to all kinds of advising and a radio show on the national level, as well as working with people in Washington and the states to build the the anti-Trump movement, the pro-immigrant
movement,
and the farm worker movement. Let's talk about Measure 105. That was, what a surprise it was. Not that they lost, but how huge
the margin.
The margin.
So the public polling in the run-up had the margin likely in, say, 15 points, roughly.
Right. And 105 was the anti-sanction. Well, it's not really a sanctuary, but
it proposed repealing Oregon's law that the Bakun movement and the ACLU led the passage of in 1987, essentially saying that local and state police and government resources shall not be used to enforce immigration laws. And Oregon was the first state in the nation to approve such a law. And the polling, I think, was in the mid-teens. It looked like it started to tighten towards the end of the election period, the pre-election period. Maybe because of the rhetoric of Trump. So why, one would ask, did it fail by 26 points, an overwhelming rejection? And the answer I find most convincing is that it became a referendum on Trump, and rightly so in some ways, Trump and his agenda. And so we saw a strong repudiation in Multnomah County, in Benton County, Lane County, the coast, even the Willamette Valley in most places. But the voters turned out, first of all, to have their say, almost 2 million voters in Oregon. And the Trump agenda is wildly unpopular, except in a few rural places.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, why don't we look at the other side? We can also say we won because the campaign to retain, quote, sanctuary status was so strong and effective. Well, why don't you tell us about that? Yes. Without that campaign, we would have lost.
So I think that's also likely, and the campaign was excellently run. They did a broad campaign starting with bringing in business and making, you know, bringing in strong business opposition, strong law enforcement opposition, not unanimous, but a strong voice to make it a public safety issue, which it clearly is.
That ad was very effective. Why don't you explain it a little?
There were several ads, but I think the one that is most central to non-Latinos, to white folks, is the justice system works when the community feels comfortable coming forward and reporting and providing information. And the example I used a lot in my description of this is, if you're a white person who's a victim of a crime and the witness to the crime is an undocumented immigrant and they don't come forward to provide their information, you are less safe. And I didn't hear too many messages that articulated it quite that fine a point.
Right.
I think people felt that that was sort of the bottom line and another reason why we, in effect, won the argument.
Yeah, and I think there's other reasons, too. A lot of churches were against it and have been vocally against it and declaring sanctuary, actually, for the last several years. And it was Bakun organizing, too. I mean, the Hispanic community itself organized enormously.
And the labor unions and the civil rights community threw in big. I think it was a great coming together, and the leadership of that campaign is to be commended. And I believe those forces will hang together to move an agenda going forward that isn't simply defeating a threat, but actually may bring about some better support for the immigrant community going forward.
In Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get to the national level. I have a hypothesis that I want to try out on you.
Okay.
there's a way in which we can be on the offensive, not even just pointing out that this is the caravan was an exodus. They really are asylum seekers, and the conditions in Central America have become. We can talk about how the U.S. has supported authoritarian interests and the corporate predators down there and maintaining them colonies of the United States, and how now we have the drug gangs and all of the rest of it who imperil and intimidate. And there's extortion rackets everywhere now in those countries, and kidnappings and the rest, and killing of labor leaders. Well, people leave countries like that, even though they don't want to. They're not interested in living through a Wisconsin or Iowa or Pennsylvania winter, even after global warming. So we can talk about that, and we should have all through the years. Is that they're a creature of American foreign policy, and it's basically a subsidy to rich companies who colonize the Honduras and other places. My theory is that, in fact, in the United States, we need immigrants. We are not going to be able to maintain our level of production, much less the need for reconstructing the economy to meet the challenge of climate change, which is going to kill all of us unless we do it. We need people who can work and can do the kind of work that people from Central America are, in fact, prepared to do. And we should talk about, and at decent pay too, of course, at living wages. Can we sell that sort of program, that we need a lot of immigration for a couple things, taking care of all sorts of older people, all of the kinds of jobs that people don't have technical skills can do, but also in terms of climate change, we need a completely new agriculture that we're not going to be able to eat on using the corn from Iowa and making it into everything and then feeding cows, and all of the rest of this industrial agriculture will not work. We're going to have to live through urban agriculture and truck farms on the outskirts of cities. And that is the ecological way to do it. And it's also the ecological way to sequester carbon. Really, organic and tilth agriculture is one of the ways that you can really lower carbon greenhouse gas concentrations through agriculture and forestry, of which the people who are coming here, many of them have histories and families who have done agriculture and are ready to do things like that. American kids don't know, no one comes from the farm anymore. Very few kids have any experience in farming. It seems to me we really need, if we're ever going to reconstruct America, it's in fact going to be a lot of immigrants from Central America and Mexico. Is that I think that is the future, actually.
Well, we have two big obstacles to overcome. One is corporate power, because those agribusiness mega companies are not going to give it up because of the general interest of the populace or humanity. That's not their history, and we shouldn't assume that they'll suddenly relent.
No, they won't, but in the crisis, they may be forced to.
Right, yeah. And the second obstacle is racial displacement anxiety that I talked about earlier, which is that autocrats and manipulators like Trump exploit the unsettled feeling that many white people have that they are going to become a minority, that we are going to become a minority in this country. Now, that there's no guarantee that white people becoming a minority is disaster for either the white people or the country, but that's the narrative that's being peddled and exacerbated by those despots. And so even though objectively what you described has a lot of merit, the appetite for it will be a struggle, especially in the near term, as long as Trump maintains his hold over the majority of the Republican base. Because what demobilizes the coalition of pro-business and pro-immigration and pro-labor forces, which came together to produce the Senate bill in 2013, what stopped that cold was the Tea Party challenges in the primaries, the Republican primaries, that started by knocking off Eric Cantor, the number two guy in the House in 2014. That stopped it cold, because what it said to Republicans was, yes, you want to serve your corporate interests and they want more immigrants for their own reasons, but you will lose your primary. You will be primaried and you will lose if you go down that road. And that's the division that now Trump has taken to a whole new level and paralyzed the Republican Party, in effect. Yeah.
Well, I think that's right. But it seems to me, and that we're not going to, in fact, win a decent immigration bill that invites people with agricultural skills to come here and get 4 acres to farm intensively near the big cities and some kind of new land grant, but of a very different kind. And also white kids from wherever they are, the suburbs and the rural areas, who also would be invited to do that kind of agriculture.
Sure, and urban farming like in Detroit.
Yeah, it's amazing how much production there is.
It's a powerful vision, I just want to say. But when you, if your question is, what's the path from here to there? Those are the some of the obstacles.
All right,
let me
make a proposal for a path, a national jobs program that I think the Democrats could, in fact, be for, because it's not going to get through the Senate and Trump. So why not be for something that everybody wants? Mm-hmm. And a National Jobs for All program, which would then focus on a couple things. One of them, jobs for people over 40, let's say, who cannot get a decent job, who've been laid off from something that was decent and could pay the mortgage, and they wind up just trying to find to get by as a security guard or whatever they minimum wage sort of.
Or an Amazon shipping center.
Yeah, or whatever it is that they can do. Mm-hmm. Something like that, a program which would be wildly popular with almost everybody. And secondly, a youth job program, including benefits. If you go through the program well, you get some college money and also reduction of college debt and all the rest of that stuff for that generation. But would be sort of a civilian conservation corps. That could be, the states could have the right to decide how to use that money for employing. And in some states, it would be to restore parts of the environment, to destroy lands that have been eroded and ruined, to, in fact, develop a different agriculture in some sorts of ways, and to provide kids with those experiences. It seems to me those are would be the, if those were popular, that would be a transitional program to something much, much greater when the need became clear that we have to reconstruct our agricultural economy.
No, I think that that could figure, both of those ideas could figure centrally in the 20s, the coming decade, which will fundamentally be about restore, repair, and rebuild.
Yes.
And it'll take an entire decade, in my view, to do it.
Yeah, but it could begin with this House of Representatives right now.
Sure, they can, and I think they will. I think we'll see them tee up some limited number of bills that they're serious about, that they'd really like to see enacted, but that also serve as a statement of distinction between, because it's not just about being against Trump. It's not just about trying to contain Trump's damage. It's also about what are you going to do to move forward. So I think those become powerful statements, but they also become concrete proposals in themselves.
Yes.
Even though they will not be enacted in this Congress.
They will not be enacted, but they can be really promoted.
Sure.
And there are even business interests who want to promote them. Now, that becomes a problem finally in the end. But agribusiness does not control the entire discourse around food and anyway, Larry,
but to our earlier point about, I think that states can also be incubators of these.
Yes,
kinds
of course.
California is a great example. I mean, they have a $9 billion surplus, and you know their new governor, Gavin Newsom. You know, this is an opportunity for him and the super majorities he has in the legislature to start some programs and demonstrate some models.
Yes, it seems to me that's such a natural program now for the even conservative Democrats, as much as they want to support. Mm-hmm. Agribusiness, it doesn't hurt them to pass this bill because it's not going to go anywhere in the Trump administration.
And also in the short run, even if it did go somewhere, let's say at the state level, it's going to start at a relatively small scale.
Right.
That won't
yeah.
immediately threaten their markets
right.
and their production
model. It seems to me a perfect program, even for the conservative Democratic Party. And it's something that a left can promote and maybe even win.
Well, so I'll certainly carry that idea with me in my conversations around the country and report back to you next you invite me to come, what I hear about that and other, you know, similar dynamics.
Well, that's good. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here always.
Thanks a lot for talking to us today, Larry Kleinman.
Thank you, Bill.